nation, O Lord of lords, how is it that this dangerous effulgence is spreading all around? Where does it come from? I do not understand. This is Arjuna, of course, speaking to Krishna, because Aswatthama has thrown this nuclear weapon called a Brahmastra toward him, and it's illuminating the sky in all directions, as we hear here. And he's wondering what to do. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada. Anything that is presented before personality of Godhead should be done so after due presentation of respectful prayers. That is the standard procedure. And Sri Arjuna, although an intimate friend of the Lord, is observing this method for general information. So, this is something we can learn in our own life. If we want to pray to God, before we ask Him for something, we should glorify Him. It's very easy to glorify Him because there's so many glorifications of Him that we're reading all the time. Bhagavad Gita, Arjuna glorifies Him. From Brahma, from Dhamma, you are the supreme Brahma and you are the supreme abode. Pavitam Paramam Mama, you are the supreme pure. Purusham Shastritam Divam, you are the original person, divine, transcendental. Adi Devam, you are the original God. Ajam, you are unborn. Vibhum, you are the greatest. So many descriptions actually here in this verse. Arjuna addresses Krishna as Deva Deva, Lord of Lords. It's also addressed in Bhagavad Gita as Lord of Lords. It's chapter 13. It would be 10, I think it's 10:15 where this is. Let's check. Yeah. Svayam evatmanatmanam vede tvam purushottam buddha bhavana bhutesha deva deva jagatpate. So this is Arjuna glorifying Krishna. He uses so many adjectives and nouns describing his situation. Purushottama, the greatest of all persons. Buddha Bhavana, the origin of everything. Bhuta Isha, O Lord of everything. Deva Deva, O Lord of all the demigods. And Jagat Pate, O Lord of the universe. So, this is described in different places by different people. When we present, we ask Krishna for something, we should preface it by this different glorification. The interesting thing to me is that this weapon is very formidable and it's coming at him. So you think normally you'd immediately, Krishna, save me! But rather than doing that, he offers like three verses of prayers. So he's like, he's really into it. You know? Very enthusiastic to glorify Krishna, even though this weapon that has the power to completely wipe out him and the area around him is coming toward him. He doesn't forget to glorify Krishna in that traumatic situation. So we and you can, if you look through the Bhagavatam, you'll find other places, like where on Rukmini's appearance day, where read that little section of this letter that she sent with a brahmana inviting Krishna to come and kidnap her. So in the beginning of that, she glorifies the Lord in so many verses before she finally gets around to the point, please come and save me from being married to this demon guy. So that's pretty straightforward. Maybe we'll go on to the next verse, unless anybody else, does anybody have any questions or comments about that?
Even before you pay your obeisances to the Lord, you should glorify first.
No, you bow down first, and then say some prayers, and then. Okay, generally, bow down first. So we'll go on to 27. Chapter 1, chapter 7, text 27. Shri Bhagavan Vacha Vete Dham Drona Putrasya Raman Astram Darshitam Naivasau Veda Samharam Pranabhata Pashtite. This is Krishna speaking, yeah? Supreme Personality of God had said, know from me that this is the act of the son of Drona. He has thrown the hymns of nuclear energy from Astra, and he does not know how to retract the glare. He has helplessly done this, being afraid of imminent death. By Srila Prabhupada. The Brahmastra is similar to the modern nuclear weapon manufactured by atomic energy. The atomic energy works wholly on total combustibility, and so the Brahmastra also acts. It creates an intolerable heat similar to atomic radiation, but the difference is that the atomic bomb is a gross type of nuclear weapon, whereas the Brahmastra is a subtle type of weapon produced by chanting hymns. There's a different science, and in the days gone by, such science was cultivated in the land of Bharatavarsha. Subtle science of chanting hymns is also material, but it has yet to be known by the modern scientists. Subtle material science is not spiritual, but it has a direct relationship with the spiritual method, which is still subtler. The chanter of hymns knew how to apply the weapon as well as how to retract it. That was perfect knowledge, but the son of Dronacharya, who made use of this subtle science, did not know how to retract. He applied it being afraid of his imminent death. And thus the practice was not only improper, but also irreligious. As a son of a Brahmana, you should not have made so many mistakes. And for such gross negligence of duty, he was to be punished by the Lord. A lot of nice points made here in the verse and the purport. So one thing is that it shows how valuable it is to have the personality of God as your friend, because he knows exactly what the problem is. You may wonder what's happening. You may inquire from someone that they, because they're not omniscient. They don't always know exactly what's going on. But Krishna knew exactly what was going on. He actually knew what, he knew that Ashwatthama didn't know how to retract the weapon, and he also knew why he did it, because he was being the super soul in everyone's heart. He knows people's motives, whether they make them clear or don't make. That's one point. And the other, another point is that there was a subtle science of, based on chanting hymns. And there's two kinds of hymns. There's material hymns and there's spiritual hymns. And in chanting material hymns or the chanting of spiritual hymns, both are unknown to the modern scientists. So basically the scientists, they know about gross matter. Bhagavad Gita chapter 7, text number 4, Krishna says, Bhumir apa nalovayu kammana buddhi evacha. There's earth, water, fire, air, ether, and the five gross elements. And then there's the three subtle elements, mind, intelligence, and false ego. So modern scientists know about the five gross elements, earth, water, fire, air, and ether. They deal with these. They can measure these with their instruments. And they can say something about the properties of these things. Sadhguru, he would classify them. He would say, earth refers to solids, water refers to liquids, air refers to gases, fire refers to radiant energy, like that. And then ether is a medium through which waves pass through that's more subtle than air. But they don't know about mind, intelligence, or false ego. There's a science called psychology, which studies the mind, but they actually don't know the mind is something that's separate from the brain. So that's it's a whole science, but a very, very fundamental piece of knowledge to know that the mind is different from the brain. They don't have, and they treat different mental diseases with different kinds of drugs that have different effects on the brain. So Prabhupada says that this science of chanting hymns is yet to be known by the modern science. Beyond the mind is the intelligence. So the all these elements are described in detail in the Srimad Bhagavatam. In the third canto, chapter 26, by Lord Kapila, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, it goes, I'll just read the descriptions of the subtle ones. Doesn't say much about the mind. It says more about the intelligence. It says the mind is a product of the mode of goodness. From false ego and the mode of goodness, another transformation takes place. From this evolves the mind, whose thoughts and reflections give rise to desire. That's a piece of knowledge about the mind. Its thoughts and reflections give rise to desire. We think about something and then we decide to do it. Prabhupada would say there's three stages: thinking, feeling, and willing. At the thinking stage, it's easy to change our mind. Then when it gets to be the feeling stage, it's harder. And the willing stage, it's harder. So the people who are actually interested in controlling the mind, you can try to control it at the thinking stage before it develops into feeling and willing. A transformation of a false ego and passion, intelligence takes birth to a virtuous lady. He's talking to his mother, Devahuti. The functions of intelligence are to help in ascertaining the nature of objects when they come into view and to help the senses. doubt, misapprehension, correct apprehension, memory and sleep, as determined by their different functions, are said to be the distinct characteristics of intelligence. So, when we try to understand what is actually going on, that's when we're using our intelligence. Mind accepts things and rejects things, whimsically, actually. But using our intelligence, we can choose to accept things that are favorable for devotional service and to reject things that are unfavorable. In this way, we can control our mind and make steady progress in devotional service. So that the intelligence is a separate, subtle element is also unknown to the modern scientists. And false ego itself is that which causes us to identify ourselves with the body and mind. Actually, as souls, we have nothing to do with this material body or the subtle mind. We have our own spiritual mind, which is transcendental to the subtle material mind and intelligence. So, but the fact that we tend to identify ourselves with our body and mind is an effect of the false ego. So these three subtle things that scientists don't know about. And then beyond those is the soul, which they don't know about either. They tend to think that the Prabhupada would say that the symptom of the soul's consciousness. You can ascertain that the soul's presence in the body, its consciousness. But the material scientists, they consider that consciousness is a product of material things. But there's actually a lot of blind faith in the science of consciousness, because they can't actually demonstrate that consciousness is a product of matter. You can't give some scientists some material elements and say, make consciousness. They can't list, you know, the steps by which it's made. There's so many things they make in laboratories. And first you do this, then you do that. You can, like when you go to your chemistry class, you have a lab and there's a whole list of different chemical elements you have to get off the shelf, and then there's different steps that you do, and then in the end you produce something. You know? So that's all very much defined. You know, how it works. There's labs that produce millions of gallons of this chemical every year. So that's a very well-defined science. But they can't say what consciousness is made of. They can't say the ingredients of it. They can't say the steps by which it's synthesized. So this whole conception that consciousness is a product of matter is actually just blind faith. And the Vedic knowledge is different. That there's another kind of energy. And it's called the spiritual energy. And just like that, there's in particle physics, they have certain irreducible particles that you can't break down. Like there's an electron, and you can't break an electron down anything beneath an electron. You know? So in the same way that the consciousness, there's a unit of consciousness called the Atma, and it's an irreducible unit of consciousness. You can't break an Atma into anything else. And that's our conscious self, which becomes, enters the body at the time of conception and leaves the body at the time of death, and which is our spiritual identity and the cause of the consciousness in this body. So, Srila Prabhupada is taking the opportunity to remind us that although the scientists are very proud of their knowledge. There's a lot that they don't know, and including this subtle science of subtle material science and the subtle spiritual science, which is even more so. So, then Prabhupada ends the purport by talking about the defect in the son of Dronacharya Ashvatthama, that he didn't have complete knowledge of the science. He knew how to send forth a weapon, but he didn't know how to retract it if he changed his mind. Of course, a lot of weapons they have nowadays, you can't really retract them either. So that actually have a weapon that you can't retract is not very good, because you can end up harming innocent people. That's a difference between the Vedic conception of warfare and modern warfare, in that that Vedic warfare was done between trained fighters on a battlefield, and the women and children and the people in general weren't involved in the conflict. And to harm a civilian was considered extremely sinful and an act of great cowardice and adharma, completely against the principles of religion. So this Ashvatthama is so degraded. He's already killed these sleeping sons of Draupadi, which is one irreligious act. And he's so deluded that he thinks his master will be pleased. So it's interesting. His master is Duryodhana, who's such a bad guy. Even though Duryodhana is such a bad guy, he tried to poison Bhima, he tried to burn the Pandavas alive in a flammable house. And he's tried to destroy them on the battlefield. Even though he had so many bad qualities, he had enough integrity to realize that it was completely abominable to kill these sleeping children who weren't part of the conflict, even though they were the children of the enemy. So this guy was really in the mode of ignorance. He was like what you would call a terrorist. A terrorist doesn't consider any kind of morality, but to advance his cause, he's willing to harm innocent people. So Ashvatthama was such a terrorist who only had partial knowledge of the military science, even though his father was a teacher of the military science. Dronacharya is the person who taught the Arjuna Achari. So we learn here that the Lord is about to punish him for his negligence in duty. And that is the position of the Supreme Lord, because no one is greater than or equal to him. He is the person who can punish everyone. And he actually comes into this world when people who are irreligious get so much power that no one can stop them. Out of paternal affection for his children suffering in this material world, when irreligious people become so powerful that no righteous kshatriya can protect society, then the Lord has to come himself as the supreme chastiser. And he did 5,000 years ago, and there are all kinds of people, like we're just reading in the Krishna book, how he killed Kamsa. Kamsa was his maternal uncle. So it's against the Vedic etiquette even to criticize your maternal uncle, to speak bad about your maternal uncle, or to speak of killing your maternal uncle. But the fact of the matter was that there was nobody in the universe who was powerful enough to kill Kamsa except Krishna. So he had to overlook this Vedic etiquette in order to protect people. So there's different levels of dharma. And it's nice to not kill your maternal uncle, but if your maternal uncle is a heinous person who has killed many innocent people and is planning to kill more innocent people, then it's all right to kill him. That's demonstrated by Krishna. So those are some thoughts from this purport. Does anybody have any questions or comments about that? Well, that's sort of a good question. I don't think it's ever said, really. But I know that Arjuna had one son named Abhimanyu who was also killed in the battle. And he was 16 years old. But I'm not sure whether these other children. Now, he was the son of Subhadra, I believe. And these other ones were sons of Draupadi. But it doesn't really make it clear how.
I wish we had
the Mahabharata. Yeah. Vridagnana Goswami was here. We could ask. Sometimes I could write him, you never know. I mean, he has a good reputation for answering his mail. I could ask. Try to remember to do that. You know how old the sleeping sons of Draupadi were who were killed by Ashwatthama? I was saying we could ask Vridagnana Goswami.
He's our
authority in Mahamaya. Yeah. Well, let's see if there's anything else I can say. Well, basically, we learn here how Krishna is the protector of his devotee. So Arjuna is in jam. This weapon that can't be counteracted is coming toward him. And Arjuna approaches Krishna, and we'll see how Krishna solves the whole problem. You can learn that if we get into a jam where there's no apparent material solution, we can also approach Krishna. And because he's supernatural, his knowledge is beyond our knowledge, and his potency is beyond our potency, he can actually help us out. Learn from this Leela depiction. So it's almost 8:28, so it's not time to go on to another verse. We'll just end here. Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami, Srila Prabhupada.